Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, you're listening to the Anderson Advisors Podcast, and today we have a really cool guest, Christopher Myers. First off, welcome, Christopher.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Chris is he's my personal counsel when it comes to working on SEC matters, oversight, fundraising, just because he's an expert in the area, and we'll kind of go over that. But he's going to go over the basics of what you should know if you're thinking about raising money for a project, whether it be for your business or for an apartment complex that you've got your eye on, or if you have other investors that you want to work with. And so he's absolutely fantastic. So again, welcome, Chris, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's kind of go over some of your background. Like, I know the background and it's pretty darn impressive. Chris has actually worked for like FINRA way back when, right? How long ago was?
Yeah, I worked there and I was getting basically a Master of Laws in business law with a focus on securities regulation. Spent a year there one semester. No, he interned there during the master's program. It was great. Some tremendously smart, caring people there. And it was just a unique insight into the FINRA world, into their great mission.
Yeah, so he's been on that side. And then he just kind of coupled it up by going in and working with the Nevada Secretary of State Securities Division, right?
Yeah, that was my first job out of law school. I practiced law here in the great state of Nevada. And, you know, my first entree into the full-time working world was with the Securities Division. I served in the capacity as a securities examiner. And essentially what that was is I reviewed all securities offerings that were being qualified and oversaw licensing of investment advisors, broker dealers, and uniquely enough, athletes agents, which was a fun change every once in a while.
I could imagine that you saw a few things there.
Yeah. You know, there are rules here in Nevada, contrary to popular belief, that not everything goes maybe down on the strip, but in the securities world, there is certainly a state dedicated to protecting their investors.
Yeah. And then you went right over to probably one of the most aggressive states, California, and you worked with the Department of Oversight in the Securities Division?
Yeah. Essentially, my wife and I were both from Southern California, and we were expecting our first child, and a desire to be a bit closer to family took us back to California, and I worked for the Securities Regulation Division within the what's now the Department of Business Oversight. Much larger organization, obviously much larger state, one of the largest economies in the world. And it was fun. I spent about a year there working with some very smart people. Again, sort of was in a role where I oversaw securities offerings and then was sort of counsel, de facto counsel to our broker dealer and investment advisor regulation unit. Got to help out on some unique stuff, but again, a tremendously passionate group of folks that, looking to make sure they protect the residents of the state of California.
Yeah. So when you say security, like we're throwing around some phrases, but anybody who has a corporation, an LLC, you're dealing with securities. The interest there is a security, right? So when you're talking about offerings and things like that, these are the people that are actually putting together both public and private offerings, right?
Correct. Yeah. Unfortunately, there is a tremendous knowledge gap, and I think understandably so, with folks trying to raise money, start a business, grow their business, and saying, hey, stock is what I see in the New York Stock Exchange, right? What I'm just raising money for my business, debt or equity. And I think what's crucial to understand and sort of put it into the most easily understandable terms is if someone gives you money and you're going to take that money and build your business, expand your business, acquire an asset, do anything where that person expects that money back plus some, or expects their money back or hopes they get anything back, you may be involved in a securities transaction. And importantly, there are a wide range of laws, both at the federal and at the state level, that apply to anybody engaged in that activity. And it's crucial before anybody takes money from another person to understand compliance is going to be necessary, both at the federal and at the state level. Some folks say, well, I'm based in California. I only have to worry about California. And I tell folks if it's actually patchwork is a little bit broader, it's going to be California and any state that you offer into in any state where you have an investor base. So it's very important for folks to understand There is a price associated with helping to raise money and grow your business. With, you know, competent counsel, laws can absolutely be complied with. It's just you want to do it beforehand and have a plan versus get to the end and go, I hope I didn't step out of bounds, because easy to do.
Yeah. So there's a few things I want to unpack there. Before I jump into that, you're now in private practice. You work with, it's Holland and Hart, right?
Correct. Yeah. I spent 2 years as a securities regulator. And after that, really had a desire to help small business owners, entrepreneurs, raise money. And I saw a lot of the pitfalls that folks stepped into. And I think something crucial for a lot of folks to understand is, I think, hey, securities regulators are only out there to get the Bernie Madoffs of the world, right? People intentionally committing fraud. Unfortunately, that's not really the majority of the issues that I saw as a securities regulator. A lot of times it's entrepreneurs that just have unknowingly engaged in a securities transaction without an exemption. They say, hey, you know, I'm raising money from a handful of rich people. How is that a securities offering, right? They invested in my LLC, or they helped me, you know, go buy that apartment building over there and or unit. How is that a securities transaction?
That's not just them putting money in for equity. That's also if you're borrowing from them, correct?
Correct. Yeah, there are certain types of debt instruments that can be considered a security. And I think the safest place to start from an assumption on an entrepreneur or business owner's standpoint is assume anytime you take money, debt or equity, that you're going to be considered to be engaged in a securities transaction. Mm-hmm. From there, we can look for exemptions or exclusions. And exclusion is what I'm doing, the nature of it, how it's structured is not considered to be a security, which is great. The second is, hey, what I'm selling, debt or equity, is in fact a security, but maybe there's an exemption that applies to me. And there's both what are called transactional exemptions, which is based on the SEC and state regulators saying, based on the nature of the people involved in this transaction, we don't need to regulate it, either because the offering is small and localized to a group of very sophisticated, wealthy investors. And there's also certain things that securities that are exempt, but usually that applies to like bank stocks and certain things. Mm-hmm. Just the average entrepreneur is not going to be selling.
Why don't you kind of go over some of those? Like, what would be an example of an exclusion, something that's not, that may, contrary to popular belief, not be a security transaction?
So there are some things where it technically, you know, can be a security, but the SEC says, listen, this is just going to be excluded from us regulating it based on the nature of the offering. And they're usually things like bank stocks or things that the average entrepreneur is just not going to be engaged in doing. But by and large, for the most part, the focus for entrepreneurs or anyone raising money is going to be a focus on what are called transactional exemptions, which are, hey, I'm selling a security, but based on the nature of the people I'm going to let participate in this offering investment, I don't need securities oversight, or I don't need to register it with the SEC or a state. I can be exempt.
Can you give me some example of some exemptions that people would have?
So a starting point at the federal level is something called Section 4A2 of the Securities Act of 1933. Section 4A2 essentially is an exemption that says you don't have to qualify a non-public offering. How that's defined is through a variety of case law and interpretive letters from the SEC. You know, it's a very broad exemption. However, in practice, it can be a little bit narrower than people think. And so folks said, hey, can you provide me any real guidance on this? And the SEC a long time ago came out with something called Regulation D. Mm-hmm. Regulation D is a safe harbor underneath 4A2 that says, hey, if you can comply with these specific set of rules, your transaction will be exempt. And traditionally, the primary exemption under Reg D was Rule 506. And Rule 506 allowed you to, through non-general solicitation, raise money from no more than 35 non-accredited investors, an unlimited number of accredited investors in theory, but there's a point where you have to become a reporting company, but allow you to raise money from accredited and non-accredited folks as long as you complied with a laundry list of requirements. When you look back, you say, wow, I had to jump through all these hoops. I've certainly done enough to sort of either add value to the company, audit financials, disclosure items, things that will inform an investor. However, traditionally, that was done through non-general solicitation. During President Obama's administration, he passed, or with Congress's help, passed something called the JOBS Act, which is an acronym for Jumpstart Our Businesses Startups Act. It was a response to one of the worst recessions this country has ever seen. Mm-hmm. And what it did was it passed a tremendously powerful exemption for entrepreneurs and business owners. And that's something called what's now known as 506C. And 506C is a transaction exemption that allows you to rely on this Regulation D exemption, but generally solicit your offering to anyone, so long as your investors prove they're accredited, which make people with, you know, net worth over $1 million exclusive of their primary residence in any deal. And it's tremendously powerful because there was a lot of entrepreneurs and business owners that said, hey, I'm willing to only have accredited investors and invest in my offering. I just don't know any rich people.
Mm-hmm. So when you say general solicitation, this is really important for people to understand. If you have a pre-existing relationship with somebody, is that an exemption from the general solicitation rules?
Yes. So general solicitation is not something that's been specifically defined by the SEC, but through guidance, case law, interpretive letters, there's some general parameters or guardrails. And yeah, the focus in general solicitation is, do you have a substantive pre-existing relationship with this person? Mm-hmm. And more than just, I know their name, I know their address. It's, I know their background. I know their middle name. I know they're financially sophisticated. You know, they're a CPA, they're, you know, a doctor, an architect. They have, you know, a level of sophistication that, you know, bypasses the average American that, you know, can understand stocks generally, but they're a person that understands investments and, you know, private deals, has an income that's relatively substantial. But you know all of that about a person, you're getting to the realm of, I have a substantive pre-existing relationship with this person. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, that sort of limited your ability to raise money to the people that you knew. And mm-hmm. if you know enough people that could finance your venture, you were in a realm of, well, what exemption can I rely on to raise the rest of this money? The Jumpstarter Businesses Startup Act, when it went into effect, said, well, you know what? You don't have to have that level of knowledge of all the people you offer to. You can go out, and as long as all the people that actually give you money are accredited, and there's certain things they have to provide as proof that they're accredited, the SEC will now exempt that transaction and let entrepreneurs raise money from folks that they may not have a pre-existing relationship with.
Are there dollar limits to that, like how much you can raise?
No, so 506C is unlimited in the amount of money that can be raised. There are certain thresholds where if you have more than a certain number of stockholders, you could eventually become a reporting company, but that's not a concern for usually the average business owner. Mm-hmm. One of the things, though, that I counsel folks on is, yes, you may have an exemption that allows you to solicit an unlimited number of people, but you don't necessarily want an unlimited number of people to come into your business, particularly if you're selling equity, because there's the exemption, but there's also the practicalities of having these people own equity in your business and have expectations. They're going to want reports, and particularly sophisticated investors or wealthy investors will oftentimes demand things that sort of match almost having a registered offering. And to be candid, I tell a lot of folks, you know, having 50 investors that you've never met before that are now essentially your boss because you have to report to them can be a big burden for a startup business. So 506C, I think, is a tool to be in a founder's or entrepreneur's tool chest, but I think that has to be used in connection with practicalities of, do I really want investors I've never met to own a part of my business?
Mm-hmm. So you're discussing, this is for accredited investors. What if it's just family members or my friend across the street and we decide to do something together?
Yeah, so Reg D, Rule 506, is a federal exemption, and that's sort of the starting point. If you do a 506 offering, you can offer in states and you make a notice filing. A lot of folks look at Reg D for when they're going to be raising money from either people they don't know or a larger offering. There are, however, state exemptions that people can rely on in addition to the large federal exemption, which is Section 482. And Nevada, for example, we have an exemption that is, if you offer to a limited number of people and you raise less than a certain dollar amount, that offering can be exempt from registration at the state level. You still have to look at the applicable federal exemptions, but Section 482 is oftentimes an exemption people rely on in connection with what's, you know, usually a small localized offering.
Friends and family, right?
So correct.
And what's the typical? Is it like 15 people or?
So it depends on the state you're in. There's a lot of states that have adopted something called the Uniform Limited Offering Exemption. And depending on what state you're in, that number can range from you raise no more money from no more than 15 people. Some states it's no more than 25. And there's usually a dollar amount associated with that. In some states, it can be, you know, as little as a million. I've seen it as at 5 million in some jurisdictions. But the crucial thing to understand in the friends and family around is, yes, they're friends and family, but they may be buying a security from you. And whether they're friends or family or not, that transaction must be exempt if it's not registered. And a lot of folks come to me and say, well, what's the, you know, I don't care, you know, what do I need to document this for? And for a lot of entrepreneurs, the big thing is corporate diligence down the line is going to pick up a non-compliant securities offering. And a lot of folks are worried about, you know, the SEC or a state securities regulator. They think, well, they're not going to know. But even if a regulator doesn't come in and identify your offering as non-compliant, you still run the risk of later stage investors saying, hey, you did a non-exempt transaction, or you didn't paper this transaction appropriately. I don't want to invest into a deal that has risk unrelated to the project business. And that's just something that entrepreneurs, you know, it can be difficult to clean up after the fact, if it in fact can be. And it's just something that I think entrepreneurs, you want to be in a position where you're either explaining your project, you're explaining your business, not trying to clean up, you know, missed paperwork.
Yeah. And this is one of the hardest parts for people to really get around, you know, get their minds around. You set up an LLC, even if it's with your buddy and your partner, and you're going to buy this, you know, it's the person you buy real estate with, and you're buying houses or apartments, or you're filling the blank. That's still a security. It's just because you guys are both partners in it, you're probably going to be exempt. It's a small amount. You're both the principals in it. You're both running it. The second you start going out saying, hey, we need extra money, and you start reaching out to people, hey, let me talk to my uncle, or let me talk to this guy I know in town who's pretty wealthy, and you're just asking even for a loan, you're still under the securities realm, and you got to make sure you don't step on a landmine. Is that essentially a correct?
Yeah, correct. And I've, you know, friends and family are great until, you know, a dispute arises. And I have seen clients that have, you know, gone out and taken money from immediate family, but not done it in a, you know, compliant way. And unfortunately, sometimes there's falling out with family. There's, you know, a business venture doesn't turn out the way everybody thought. And if slighted, you know, they can report, they can call their local securities division, they can try and call the SEC, but they can call someone and say, hey, you know what, I put money into this deal. I don't think it was done right. Is there anything you can do? And that's just not something that you want to have to deal with, in addition to, you know, a busted business venture, is a call from a regulator trying to find out, hey, have you done something nefarious here? And with proper planning, it can easily be addressed up front. It's just crucial for a lot of business owners to understand that these laws do apply. Even if you have an exemption, the laws still apply. You just need to make sure you either paper that exemption or tailor your offering in a way that qualifies for an exemption.
Are you looking to lower your taxes, protect your assets, and grow your wealth? Are you a real estate investor, stock trader, or business owner? If you answered yes, Anderson Advisors Tax and Asset Protection Workshop is for you. Let hosts Clint Coons, Toby Mathis, and Michael Bowman teach you how to protect and keep more of what you earn. Our workshops are held monthly throughout the country and via live stream. 2 in-person tickets to the workshop are only $99. To learn more about the dates and locations, visit AndersonAP.com and register today.
Do you remember any cases that you ran across where you were like, oh man, this is so, the guy didn't, or the person did not mean to step on any landmines, but when they do step on it, you know, where you were like, I feel kind of bad?
Yeah, there's, you know, a handful of examples that I see or cases I hear about. One is engaging in general solicitation without a proper exemption. And folks will say, well, you know, I only sold to like 10 people. Well, if you offered to people you didn't know, that's general, or didn't have a substantive pre-existing relationship with, you in fact engaged in general solicitation. And there's folks sometimes go, well, I didn't offer a security. I just said I was raising money. Well, anything that primes the markets for securities transaction can be considered an offer of a security. And I've been at, you know, startup events where I hear entrepreneurs say, you know, hey, I'm raising, you know, stock, or I'm selling stock at this price and at this valuation, and they don't know it, but they've just generally solicited an entire room full of people.
What's the ramification if they do it?
Correct. And sometimes those folks will have exemptions in place and they say, hey, no, I'm allowed to do this. I'm relying on 506C. I'm only going to take money from people that prove they're accredited. And sometimes I see it in the context of, hey, all I did was, you know, I engaged in general solicitation. That's fine. I was going to rely on Rule 506, but they didn't take proper steps to verify that investors were accredited. Mm-hmm. And he has come out and said, even if people ultimately wind up to be accredited, right? Assume a person raises money, they generally solicit, you know, send out a blast email, you know, something to that effect, but they only take money from you know, 10 people. Those people wind up being accredited. The SEC has come out and said, even if those folks are in fact ultimately determined to be accredited, if you didn't take the proper steps to verify that those folks were in fact accredited at the time they made their money, that's a non-compliant 506 offering. And because you engaged in general solicitation, now you don't have an exemption. And those folks are in a very tough spot where, you know, not asking for one or two more pieces of documentation could have exempted their offering. Now they're in a non-compliant space.
Now, if you're non-compliant, do you end up, is it disgorgement? Is it penalties? Is it jail time? What is it if you're non-compliant?
So non-compliance, the penalties for non-compliance can range broadly depending upon the regulator you're dealing with, whether you're dealing with an investor that's suing you, the SEC. The penalties can be broad. And there's, you know, a lot of folks think, well, I didn't take their money and, you know, keep it, or, you know, this wasn't a Ponzi scheme. The business just went down, or, hey, the business actually made money and everybody's really happy. A baseline remedy will be a securities regulator saying, hey, you need to register this transaction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks, that's not going to be possible. So in those moments, regulators sometimes will say, okay, well, then you need to offer everybody their money back in what's called the rescission offer. And for a lot of folks that are startup business owners, or they, you know, are trying to, you know, buy you know, real estate asset, and they're in the early years of either rehabbing the project or it's not stabilized, it's not rented out, coming back to an investor and saying, hey, do you want all your money back? Can be a very enticing person that says, well, what's the company worth? What's the project worth? Mm-hmm. You're sitting there saying, well, we're in that sort of down period where we raised money, all the cash is out. You know, technically, if you got all your money back right now, as of today, it'd be a better return. You know, it can really kill a business to have to go through that, whether through...
They have a regulator involved. I mean, somebody probably blew the whistle on it, right? Like somebody, probably bad stuff's going on and you're in a precarious position, and all of a sudden they come in and say, you got to give everybody back their money. They're like, we don't have their money.
Correct. And that can be, so regulators can get tip, can learn of a busted offering in a handful of ways. One can be someone's told, right? Sometimes it's an investor that's frustrated. Sometimes it's, you know, a securities broker or to be often sometimes a competitor says, hey, I learned that this person was raising money. You should go check it out because I don't think they're doing it in a compliant way. Another can be folks just, you know, again, not knowing what they're doing as a securities transaction can sometimes send out flyers. I've seen advertisements in newspapers that are securities offerings. And, you know, sometimes there, again, there can be exemptions for some of that activity. But quite often when I was a regulator and we would reach out to people and say, hey, we saw that you're doing this activity. Can you please confirm what exemption you're relying on? And oftentimes people are like, you would say, you know, I don't have a lawyer. I didn't know what I was doing was a securities transaction. What do you recommend that I do? So if you're asking for securities advice from a securities regulator, you've probably done something wrong. Mm-hmm. The securities regulator, it's not their job to help you comply or plan your offering. It's their job to protect their citizens, right? And if you're raising money in a non-compliant way, you've violated a law that they're sworn to enforce. And if you get to that point with the regulator, it's not because they're nefarious. It's not because they're out to get anybody. It's because they have a set of laws they have to enforce. And if you violated it and they know about it, they have to take action against you.
Can they throw you in jail for doing stuff like that?
Depending on the nature of the violation, there are certain securities crimes that are punishable by imprisonment. You look at Mr. Madoff, who's, you know, currently a resident of the federal correctional system. You know, that's certainly very egregious activity. lesser activity that can get folks in trouble criminally as well. And sometimes what can make taking action from civil to criminal is either repeated offenses, an intent to defraud investors, or actions that can only be interpreted as an intent to defraud investors.
So assuming that all of our people listening, they just want to do things right. In fact, a lot of them are just scared to death of even going out and raising money because they know these rules exist, but they don't know what they are. How do you do it right? Let's say that I want to, I have a great apartment building that I got my eye on, and I know that we could run it and make a good chunk of money, leverage it up, fix it up, and possibly sell it in 2 or 3 years and really make a killing. And I'm thinking, boy, I would really love to go see if there's somebody that wants to do this with me. What would be my steps?
So I think step one is looking at the process of raising money like a road trip. You need to know where you want to end up, and you need to know where you're starting. And I often tell folks, do you plug in the MapQuest directions before you get in the car, or do you do it when you're already on the freeway hoping you're going in the right direction? What I recommend to folks is, using the MapQuest example, is plug in the destination before you get in the car. Know where you're going, know where you want to be, and really just look at the roadmap of how you're going to have to get there. And I strongly encourage investors or anybody trying to raise money, don't do that on your own, right? Don't try and take out the map and think you know the best route. Contact a securities attorney, contact someone that can help you through that entire process. And I think the key is making sure, vetting the person a bit and making sure you truly believe that they have the skill set to assist you. Unfortunately, I run into folks that have gone out and they've engaged either legal counsel or someone that purported to be an expert, and the advice they've gotten is either incorrect, not complete, or just, completely wrong. And, you have an entrepreneur that's sort of gone the route of trying to get advice and they just didn't get it correctly. Mm-hmm. But a starting point is knowing where you want to wind up and identifying someone to help you get there.
And so assume that I'm going to raise $2 million to do this apartment. And I sit down with you and I say, you know what, these are people that I actually know exactly who I'm going to talk to. It's a bunch of investors that I work with. What's typically, I'm going to do a 506C, do a Reg D or something along those lines?
So in any number of facts can sort of differ the advice that an attorney would give in a situation like that. But I think the crucial analysis is for the person trying to raise the money to look at both with their counsel, both a federal exemption and a state exemption. Mm-hmm. To understand, okay, do I know these people? Have I done business with them before? Are they sophisticated? What's their net worth? And I think helps to answer the federal and state securities law questions. From a state standpoint, it's crucial to understand where are these folks? Where do they actually live? Because I've dealt with entrepreneurs before that'll say, well, hey, this person is in Washington state, and we'll look at the securities laws in Washington, because it's crucial to understand that all offers and sales must be exempt. So you can even approach that person about investing, you need to have a securities exemption identified to even approach them about the offering. And I've had instances where, a person comes back and says, well, I moved. I'm not in Washington anymore. I'm now in Illinois. And now you're in a moment where you go, uh-oh. What's the law in Illinois say? Right. So depending on the nature of the prospective investors, if you know that in advance, identifying the federal and state laws that you can rely on. If a person raising money says, hey, I don't know who the investors are going to be, then we're looking at exemptions where we can what's called preempt state law. And that's a moment where Rule 506, which is a federal exemption that preempts the application registration requirements, not the fraud requirements or notice filing requirements. Rule 506 can say, hey, as long as you comply with this federal rule, you can file notice with these state securities regulators, and that will be sufficient. You're still subject to prosecution for things like fraud, but you can now focus on one set of laws from a upfront compliance standpoint.
That sounds pretty tasty for somebody who's going to raise money, and you might have 20 people all across the country. That sounds like...
Regulation D, Rule 506 is a very popular exemption with entrepreneurs. And again, one of the big things there is, hey, I don't know who all my investors are going to be. And then you get into an analysis of, well, do I do a 506B offering or do I do a 506C offering? And how do they differ? And what are the pluses and minuses associated with each one?
Mm-hmm.
We encourage entrepreneurs, if they are in a position where they truly do not know who their investors are going to be, they're going to have a lot of conversations. They're going to have conversations with people that they don't know. They're going to ask their friends and family for referrals of people that, you know, you're starting to get one or two concentric circles outside of your direct contact base.
Mm-hmm.
Really encourage folks to look at Rule 506C because, again, it is an exemption from registration that allows you to engage in general solicitation without having to be look over your shoulder.
And then you're actually registering your offering as a Reg D offering. You're letting the SEC and the states know, hey, I'm out here raising money.
So Regulation D, it's not registration. It's a notice filing that you've engaged in an exempt transaction. And mm-hmm. that's the weeds on what an entrepreneur needs to know. But yes, you file what's called a Form D with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. And then you will provide that same filing to the states in which you sell securities in. So a person that, you know, is getting ready to conduct a securities offering says, you know what, here's the nature of my investors. Here's the nature of people I'm targeting. They ultimately determine that they're counsel to rely on Rule 506. Mm-hmm. That person would then look at the 506 notice filing requirements and that's in the states they want to sell into. And then they would, with their counsel, file a Form D with the SEC and then file a Form D in the states where they have investors.
Are there people that just skip that say, hey, I'm going to deal with accredited investors. I know that I'm meeting all the requirements. And if a regulator ever comes in, I'll just file it then. Are there people that do that?
There are absolutely people that do that. That's never something that I recommend because unfortunately there are some states that say, and the SEC, a willful failure to file a Form D can vitiate your ability to claim that exemption.
Yep. Then all of a sudden you're in hot water again. So we'll do it right.
You're back in hot water. You're sort of scrambling to see, do I have a securities exemption that I can fall back onto? And what I tell folks is you always want to have a fallback point where you can say, if I somehow didn't qualify with this exemption, I have another one that I can probably rely on. Because mm-hmm. is a very narrow focused exemption with a lot of requirements to comply with it. There are some broader, more lax exemptions around Reg D. However, the ability to rely on those really goes out the window with things like general solicitation, taking money from people you don't know, or raising over a certain dollar amount, or raising money from more than a certain number of people.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
All right. So let's assume that we're going to do it right. We actually file our notice, our Form D. Then we always hear about, hey, accredited investors, how do I verify? And do I have to verify that they're accredited? And then what about this whole thing called an offering memorandum? What are all these things that what are the next steps that I have to worry about?
Yeah, so there are folks that say, okay, well, I know I want to comply with securities laws. What do I do? So if people engaging in Rule 5, if they're going to rely on Rule 506 as an example, Rule 506 has two avenues. There's the 506B avenue, which is no general solicitation, and there's the 506C avenue, which is general solicitation. Mm-hmm. On the 506B approach, folks are not required to have definitive proof that a person is in fact accredited. They can rely on what's called self-certification. And that's mm-hmm. usually in the form of an accredited investor questionnaire where the issuer or the entrepreneur, whoever's raising money, will send out a questionnaire that says, check on this box how you're accredited. You have a net worth over $1 million. You have a household income of over $300,000 annually. Tell me how you're accredited. And that person will just check a box, sign it and say, I promise that I'm accredited this way. In contrast, Rule 506C offerings, because you're engaging in general solicitation and your offering is being, you know, sent out to sort of, you know, people you don't know, there is a higher threshold there. And in those situations, the SEC is going to make you have proof that you went out and proved these people were accredited. There's a handful of ways that the SEC has come out and presented as methods that you can use to verify a person is accredited. One is getting a letter from their accountant, or a CPA, an attorney, saying this person is in fact accredited. Another is to see, start asking things like W-2s, tax returns, but they have to be current, right? A W-2 from a job is no longer at is not sufficient. There's a handful of other approaches. The SEC has said, if you rely on one of these methods to prove people are accredited, we'll deem that to be you proving that they're accredited.
There's some online services too, though. You can go in and they plug it in and then it
correct. There's a variety of these certification firms that have popped up. I say you always want to vet those. I think you want to have what I call the quarterback on the transaction. Someone that's going to help, is going to focus on helping you comply with all securities laws, making sure you select proper vendors to help with certification compliance. And then have really focus on the business, the interaction with investors, explaining their concept, their proposal to folks, and letting people that specialize in securities compliance kind of take over that approach. I kind of look at it as, if I'm going to go do surgery or I need surgery on my knee, I'm not going to go down to the Home Depot and buy an X-Acto knife and try and figure it out, right? That's what
that's
they
just
do.
Gross.
Yeah.
Get some screws, put them on in there, get a drill.
Correct. You know, maybe you poke around long enough, you find the ACL, and maybe you duct tape it. But the security space, for folks though in the security space, what they need to understand though is that they are not taking a risk. Their investors are taking a risk. And because people are giving you money, it must be done in a compliant way. And if you can go out and you can, you know, comply with the requirements under 506B, 506C, or some other exemption you're relying on, now you can just focus on the core business.
And then it gets to this thing, and we see this all the time, and it drives me absolutely crazy. They do the offering memorandum, and that's almost where everybody starts. We're into this conversation now, and we're finally to the point where we actually have the offering memorandum. And most people, that's where they start. And the offering memorandum is where you're like, oh, I'm going to go entice all these people. It's going to be so great. And, you know, and it's basically you're putting you could lose all your money together. You could lose all your money statement right at the beginning of like, hey, this is for, you know, sophisticated investors, is for credit investors and all that good stuff.
Yeah, and the offering memorandum can be tough. And there are some folks that say, hey, I'm raising money from, you know, friends and family, immediate people that I know. What do I really have to tell them? And I think disclosure of certain key risk factors in a moment where it's friends and a very limited offering. I've seen folks say, do I really need a full-blown 60-page offering memorandum when I'm taking a limited amount of money from people that I more than a substance of pre-existing relationship with? This is my tribe, right? I know them. I know everything about them. That's a moment where working with securities counsel, folks may be able to say, you know what? I'm going to take a different approach. I'm going to disclose risk factors a certain way. I'm going to have a reduced set of subscription documents, but I'm still going to pay for the transaction, disclose material risks. When folks go out to people they either don't know or they start to go out to a larger group of investors, an offering memorandum becomes crucial both for purposes of qualifying for certain exemptions. Certain exemptions require investors receive a certain set of disclosures, risk factors, summary of management, what they're up to. It really importantly, use of proceeds. What's money going to be spent on? And, you know, who's going to get what fees or conflicts of interest? Really explaining an investment to your investors. And it is, a lot of folks look at it as it's just an expense I don't need. And I really look at it as just cost of doing business. If you want to build out, you know, you want to buy an apartment complex, you're going to have to pull permits. You're going to have the city come inspect different phases of construction. And an offer memorandum for folks that are looking to invest in real estate, I look at to the entrepreneurs, this is just one more permit you have to pull. It's an expense where maybe you don't do it, maybe nothing comes of it, but if it does, it's something you wish you would have done 9 out of 10 times.
It's a complete cover your backside. It's disclosing everything so somebody cannot come to you and say, you made me and you enticed me and you misrepresented. It's almost like the fraud defense. It just kind of throws them right. Like, you know, this was all disclosed to you right at the very beginning. So you put all the horrible stuff that could happen in there, right?
Correct. Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of disputes that I see both in private practice and when I was a securities regulator were based around just sort of misunderstanding of the offering. Either people not understanding the nature of their investment, which is sort of a red flag from the beginning of, is this person really as sophisticated as I think they are? Mm-hmm. Is not understanding use of proceeds appropriately. There are certain folks that will say, well, you know what? I'm going to go buy a fourplex and I'm going to fix it up and I'm going to flip it. It's going to take me 6 to 9 months to do that. And obviously I'm going to be compensated for my time in the form of a development fee, a management fee, a salary, some kind of expense like that. However, an investor sometimes will come back and say, hey, you never told me you were going to take a management fee, a development mm-hmm. fee. You know, you just said that you were going to go buy the apartment building and flip it. Had I known you were going to take a development fee or some type of fee, I wouldn't have invested. Mm-hmm. And it's crucial for folks to explain basically as much as they can about the project, as much as they can about use of proceeds. Because if you can sort of cut off at the beginning any argument that a person can have of, I didn't know X, Y, or Z, you're in a much better position to hopefully, you know, yes, defend any type of claim that may come. More importantly, hopefully cut off the desire of a person to bring a claim. And mm-hmm. that's both for information and for making sure that your investors are right for the product. I have folks that will say, well, I complied with all the exemptions. I have a PPM or an offer memorandum. I'm doing a 506. I filed it with the SEC. I filed it in a state where these investors are. I'm free and clear. And I think there's, you know, technical compliance with the rule, but there's also really understanding the practical nature of taking money from people. Mm-hmm. A big rule of thumb that I have, and that some states will actually impose, FINRA has rules like this for their brokers, is don't take more than a certain percentage of a person's liquid net worth. If a person writes you a check and says, I'm all in and I like the investment, I like the product, and you say, what do you mean all in? You know, and sometimes that all in is, no, I gave you all the money in my bank account. And if this doesn't pay off,
run.
I'm bankrupt. Mm-hmm. That in my opinion, that is never an investor that you want. As a rule of thumb that I have for folks, and again, this is my rule of thumb, not my firm's or any of my colleagues, is a 10% test. You're going to take more than 10% of a person's net worth. I think you really need to evaluate, is this the appropriate person for me? Or do I want to sort of count them against being too in? Because life happens after investments are made. People jobs, recessions hit, people need cash for unexpected, you know, emergencies, health issues come up. And you're sitting there and you've taken half their savings account or a large portion of their net worth. That person, notwithstanding the project performing well, notwithstanding that person set to receive a large return on the back end, is going to become difficult because they just need the cash now. And the entity is either, you know, not able to make that distribution, not able to give that investor the money back. You could have an issue where a person is starting to either make claims, call regulators, do something just because they're desperate to get cash back.
Yeah. And I just share you one interesting scenario was, it was a private placement back in 2000. It was year 2000, early 2001. It involved some banking. It was some money transfer technology. And 9/11 happened, and it made it virtually worthless at the time. But the technology, the intellectual property, ended up still being somewhat valuable, and the company ended up doing a merger with another company. And literally, you fast forward 19 years, and the investment, you know, bore fruit. It actually, a company went public, and the initial investors ended up with shares in that company, ended up with restricted shares, but they ended up doing quite well after the case, because they were able to weather that storm. During that same period of time, the original folks that had started the money raise were settling out disputes. I don't think they went to lawsuits, but the people that were hurting for cash, A, lost the opportunity to participate in that growth, and B, were the ones that squawked the loudest. And so I always just kind of keep that in the back of my head, is that it's not good for them. It's not good for you. It's not good for the person who comes in. Is you want to be dealing with adults that understand this is a risk and are able to weather that storm. This isn't the money that they need to live off of in 2 years, and they're not banking on you returning their investment plus this so that they could make their living or they can retire or something. You need to make it to where this is actually an investment. You know, that's just my, from my standpoint. I'm not a securities attorney. I don't pretend to be. I always look at this and say, I like to kick them over to you, Chris, because you're non-promotion about it. Some of these folks, they go and they sell the PPM and they're saying, hey, we can go out and raise money. And they skip the whole, you know, registration part, and they skip the whole, here's who you can solicit and here's the rules. They go right to the, let's do this enticing salesy business plan, private placement memorandum that we can go pitch to people, and you can raise a whole bunch of money. And I just think that that's buying people a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I call it the furniture without the instructions, right? I recently bought an end table from a retail outlet here. And, you know, I dropped all the pieces out and I said, oh my gosh, I don't have the instructions. What am I going to do? I got to.
Was it Swedish?
It may be. I don't know. I don't want to violate any copyright or trademark. But I
look at a lawyer.
I got a $160 pile of wood here. Lucky for me, I just missed the instructions inside of the box. But yeah, the product without the instructions can be difficult. I think entrepreneurs need to really make sure that they understand both, you know, not only the rules, but the spirit behind them. Again, having been a securities regulator, I can assure you that folks are not out to make entrepreneurs difficult. They are not out to have a gotcha moment with folks. They are really out to help preserve the integrity of this securities marketplace. Mm-hmm. Entrepreneurs can continue to raise money. If you look at the integrity of our financial system here in the United States, we have one of the more transparent securities markets. People feel more comfortable putting their money to work in the United States. And that's because we have securities regulators that ensure folks are not doing nefarious things. Mm-hmm. And we have to have rules to help them do that. And
absolutely,
entrepreneurs that can sort of come to understand regulators are people to work with, be prepared for, and understand where they're coming from, are going to be in a much better position than folks that sort of take the ostrich in the sand approach. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to worry about it because, you know, everybody else I know doesn't get caught.
When it's sunny, you don't need a roof, you know? So
but you
don't want to build your house without a roof because ultimately it's going to rain. And, you know, you just want to be prepared for that. This is how you prepare it. You know, this is your roof. And it sucks that you have to go through the expense. I know we'd all love to be able to ignore that aspect of it and say we don't have to worry about, we're not going to be in that scenario. We're not going to lose money, or we're not going to have rough times, or there's never going to be a situation where somebody's cash poor and needs their money back and we're not able to provide it. But it happens all the time. I'm sure you've seen it.
Correct. It happens all the time, and you never want to be in a position where something you could have an ounce of preventative maintenance now, but a cure later. And businesses fail all the time. Ventures fail all the time. You know, real estate markets, securities markets go up and down. But if you can be in the position where you say, hey, I fully complied with both federal and state securities laws. I did exactly what I said I was going to do with your money. I told you about the risks inherent in an investment like this. I didn't take too much of your money, so you shouldn't be upset. If you can do all those things, all of which are 100% in the control of the entrepreneur, if the unexpected happens with respect to the marketplace, the project, the investment, that happens. But if you can have controlled everything you can, you're going to be in a much better way to deal with that potential downside.
Well, I really appreciate it. We went way over, but I love talking with you. So it's like, I don't care. Here's the thing. Could you give them a phone number where if somebody wanted to reach out to you, somebody's a little bit worried, or somebody is in a situation where they're trying to raise money, that they could actually get a hold of you?
Yeah. So my number is 702-669-4621. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Holland and Hart.
I'll put your information up as well, but some of these folks listen to it on a podcast where they don't see, and they're not looking at it on the internet. They're just listening. But I would like, this is one of the most important phone calls you can make. And I'm sitting here as a tax guy, I am a licensed attorney, but I don't pretend to be a securities attorney by any extent. And I'm just saying, the second somebody says, I'm raising money or I'm getting money from other people is when I usually say, hey, you really need a securities lawyer to look at it, make sure you don't step on a landmine. And I always send them to Chris.
Absolutely. And whether it's me or someone else, as long as it's someone that knows what they're doing, that's absolutely a tremendously important call to make. And vice versa, that the once you get past the securities piece, unfortunately, there's all kinds of others. Tax reporting, the whole nine yards. And again, when you're dealing with other people's money, it's important to make sure you're shepherding it well.
Well, I really appreciate it, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And thank you again.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.